You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and this is the Comedian's Comedian, the only podcast about comedy. And today it's a very embarrassed podcast. This podcast is very naughtily and shamefacedly admitting that it's been sitting on this episode with Anne Edmondson for over a year. I'm very sorry to Anne for my ineptitude and ability to put this out on time. Sometimes that just happens. I've got one left over from Just for Laughs last year as well with the brilliant K. Trevor Wilson. And when's that coming out? Soon, I hope. But sometimes lots of other time-sensitive podcasts get in the way and people end up getting bumped back and occasionally lost and refound. So enormous apologies to Anne and congratulations on her nomination for the Barry Award at the Melbourne Comedy Festival just gone. This is a really fun interview. She's so much fun. She's so talented. And I was gutted not to be in Melbourne this year to watch I don't know how to describe a new creation of Anne's, which I won't go into detail here, but I'm hoping she's coming to the Edinburgh Fringe this year. I'm not sure if she is. She has a TV show in Australia called The Edge of the Bush, which is no doubt taking up lots of her time as well. So nonetheless, if you get the chance to see Anne Edmonds in any hemisphere, pick a hemisphere, I really recommend you see her. This is the fabulous Edo.
Let's start. We met each other backstage at the gala.
Yes.
And I think, did we meet at the previous night at Catfish, was it? I saw you at Catfish
set. Yes, you
but
were there.
I was jet lagged and all over the place.
But you were funny.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You were fucking great. Your gala set was great as well. It's really exciting for me to come and meet a load of acts and see a load of acts that I've never seen before. I've got to stop asking people what kind of comedy they do. I want to kind of flesh out what it is you do for the listener who may not have seen you. It seemed to me that you specialize in kind of, it's stand-up, but it's stand-up through the lens of a kind of menagerie of grotesques.
Yes.
That you embody very well.
Mm.
Like you're like a character observationalist.
Yes. So if I'm telling a story, I'm going to and all of my bits are stories. They're longer. I rarely got just one joke. You know when they ask you to do a joke in a magazine, I've never got one. I've always got a 5-minute story. And in that story, I'll always take on the characters. Rather than just say, this happened, I'll embody the character rather than just talk about what went on. That's my preferred method. Yeah.
Yes. And how long have you been doing it?
Comedy?
Yeah.
It's about 9 years now. I started quite late. So I'm 38, so I started when I was about 29. So, about 9 years.
And where are you in the, God, I almost said firmament there, pantheon? What's the word? Where are you in comedy? Where are you in Aussie comedy? Are you like a headliner in clubs or whatever? I mean, because I know there's not so much a circuit here. I know there are clubs, obviously, but everyone seems to have a wildly different. You need to be much more of a portfolio performer over here, I think.
Yeah.
Rather than someone who can just float around the circuit.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I'm probably still, I would say I'm still considered a newcomer, like a new comic. And I'm sort of at the level now of not having to worry about selling tickets at festivals. So that's nice.
And is it fair to say that the festivals kind of, it seems to me, or maybe this is true, it seems to me that the festivals, if you have a good run of festivals for however many months, there's 3 months, that kind of pays your rent for the rest of the year.
It can do in Australia, yeah. Like if you can sort yourself out in festival time. And then, but you sort of, in Australia, you sort of need the TV. The TV gives you a real boost. I mean, I've been on the circuit now, the festival circuit for 7 years. And I think that you know, turning up every year, but you do a little bit of TV presence in Australia goes a long way. You suddenly jump significantly, you know, like you jump double the seats or something with a little, just a little bit of telly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's your, I'm familiar, I saw your show in here a couple of weeks ago and I saw you at the gala, obviously. I'm aware that you've done lots of other exciting stuff, including your own sitcom.
Yes.
Character sitcom, which you've been developing today.
Yes. No, so I've already shot that and we had a launch of it on Monday. Okay. So that's going on the telly later in the year in Australia. So that's a multi-character. I play four different characters in the same show. So I've been working on that.
Someone told me the situation, which is that it's a calisthenics dynasty torn apart by incest.
Yeah.
Fuck, I love every word in that sentence.
Yeah. So do you have calisthenics in the UK?
No, aerobics, is that the same thing?
It's sort of this, it's actually, I think it was invented here. It's a combination of dance and gymnastics. It's this bizarre, and there's a lot of sequins and a lot of eight-year-olds with fake tans and makeup, full faces of makeup. It's a bizarre little world. So it's situated in that world. But it's all about what went on in the past to cause a family breakdown, which I'm a little bit obsessed with, I guess, the psychology of people. Like every character I embody or take on, I'm they're all often dark characters, and it's often I'm often interested in what's happened to them in the past. It's big for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. I just feel like everybody's got something dark going on. Like, and my favourite thing is to look at happy people in particular and people who particularly are presenting a facade of happiness and try and sniff out what their insecurities might be or what could have gone wrong in their lives. And I don't know where that morbid, horrible... I'm like, no one's true... I guess because I'm not truly happy. I'm like, no one could be truly happy around here, surely. Surely everybody's like got some demon going on.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when at what point did you become, did you start to have a sense that that was your idiom?
Yeah, I think probably my show 2 years ago, I really switched, not switched, but this stuff that had been coming on for a while, this sort of dark character stuff really kicked in. Because that show was about, it was about my own happiness and the desire, like the pressure to be happy in as opposed to sad, like happiness is more important than sadness, which it's not necessarily the case. Like sadness is as important as happiness. So that was what that show was about. And through that show, I talked about myself, but then I looked into everybody else as well. I was like, see this, it appears this way, but it's not.
And when you say everybody else, you mean in terms of the characters in that show?
Yes. So that show was based on a lot of eavesdropping, where I'd hear like one or two. It actually followed on from a blog I'd been writing where I'd hear a sentence in a cafe or something and then just that one sentence, I'd run away with a whole story about how those, particularly like two people had arrived in a cafe together, what's gone on. And normally it's misery. So
normally it's misery that you're interpreting from the actual situation.
Yes. So
like that's the reason it catches your ear.
Yeah. Like it might be something like, oh, no, if you don't want to come tonight, that's fine. I'm happy to go on my own. Just something as simple as that, which may just be as simple as that. But for me, that just opens up a whole, I don't know, area of what, you know, like you're not really happy to go on your own. You really wanted them to come, you know, all those sorts of things.
Yes.
And that's what I'm fascinated by. Little snippets from ordinary people, I guess.
And how does that differ from what you started off doing? And before we get to that, let's just, how did you bring yourself to comedy? You started late. What was your first step into?
I actually started as in character comedy, and I was living up in Darwin in the north of Australia, and a friend of mine was getting into comedy, and she said, let's pitch some sketches to the ABC up there, which was a bit of a wild idea. And we did, and they took us up on it, which was... Like that's such a weird first experience, you know. Most people pitch for like 8 years. I was like, I haven't done comedy before, and I'd like to make sketches. And they were like, all right.
Wow, why? Why was that? The strength of the pitch, or the right?
I think more just being in Darwin and no one doing anything like that up there ever. So probably just the ABC had some spare cash, and they were like, oh, all right, have a go. So we did, and my first experience was performing a character that I'd written in a sketch. Which as soon as I did it, I went, oh, like I had a light bulb, like lightning bolt kind of moment about my life.
Okay.
Yeah, and went, oh, that's what, oh, I get it now. This is what I'm supposed to be doing.
And who had you been up until that point? Did you get the sense there was something not there?
Yeah, so I was working in like office jobs and for the government and doing jobs like that. But before, like I've always written music, so I was doing a bit of that. And then I was also, I had this sense that there was something more I had to do, but I did not understand what it was.
And was that frustrating? Were you happy at the time? Did it make you unhappy?
I remember being quite discontent with what I was doing, but not really understanding why. If that makes sense. Yeah, just being like, this life I'm leading isn't, I'm not doing anything with my life, I guess.
And had you had any kind of forays into performance at school or anything like that?
Not really, but I'd been like at Christmas time and stuff like that in my family, I was always offering up performances, like even just piano. Like I played the piano, so I'd make everyone stop and listen to me playing the piano. And then I did go into it. I was in a women's choir in my early 20s, and then the music as well. Like I had performance urges, I guess, often. Mm.
And you were aware that something was missing from life, not necessarily. I mean, were you kind of watching comedy and thinking, oh, that's I should be doing
yeah,
that?
Yeah, a little bit. Like I'd always watched. Well, I'd always watched comedy like on the telly. My mum and I used to sit up till quite late watching a lot of UK comedy, actually, like French and Saunders and people like that. And so I had this idea from that was a valuable thing to do with your life, comedy. Like I had got that sense from my mum that was an important.
Because of her love for those shows.
Yes, yeah.
That's a lovely way of putting it, a valuable thing to do with your life.
Yeah, yeah, like that's a worthwhile pursuit, I guess. And then I remember seeing a show in my early 20s in the comedy festival called Brian Munich and Friends, which was a sort of surreal sort of comedy, character-based comedy that I hadn't seen before. And I remember thinking, that's one of the best things you could do. I remember thinking that in the pub afterwards, having a drink. I was like, that would be an amazing thing to do.
It's interesting. Those, the way of talking about that, valuable, that would be the best thing to do. They're all very positive.
Mm.
It sounds like that's coming from a very positive place, like wanting to go towards the light rather than away from the darkness. Do you know what I mean? In terms of like the origin of a lot of comics, it's like, oh, I was miserable and I wanted some sort of escape route.
Yeah.
Whereas actually that's quite refreshing to hear someone go, these things all sounded good.
Well, I thought I thought comedy was a value. Yeah, I placed value on it, I guess, as an important thing to do.
So when you first did your character, who was that first character?
Her name was Raylene the Racist. And it was a sketch about, it was a sketch I wrote having watched on the news a rural town getting angry at local Muslims for trying to build a mosque and trying to run them out of town, basically. And the sketch was about, imagine you got run out of town for being a racist. So it was about her, because Darwin's quite a racist place. So it was about a woman who'd moved to fled Melbourne, which is too left-wing for Darwin because of her racist tendencies.
Okay.
Yeah. And it kind of went quite viral.
Yeah, that's already, I mean, that's nuts to me to think that, like, your first foray into it went viral.
It was
like, your
crazy.
First thing, someone picked it up and put it on telly. And then it went viral, straight off. That's nuts.
And I didn't know really quite how to cope with it because it was a lot of people thought, in particularly in America, that it was real. So suddenly I was having my first ever comedy experience and about 70,000 people had seen it.
Jesus, and presumably left comments on it and abuse.
All that stuff.
From the word go, from day one.
Yeah, so I was kind of in my, I remember hiding, I reckon, for about a week and just being like, what have I done? Like, I guess I hadn't thought through yet what the fallout of comedy could be.
Yeah, why would you?
Yeah, no. Yeah, so that was an interesting way to start. Mm.
And what was what were the next steps from that stage? How did it
come? So I then, there was only so much I could do in Darwin, and I started looking into some, you know, comics that I really liked and realised that all of them had done live comedy and that live comedy was something pretty important. So I came back to Melbourne, came home and hit did Raw Comedy, which is our, like, sort of, I don't know what you've got in the UK.
So You Think You're Funny.
Yeah.
It's a similar.
Yeah,
well, they're tied together somehow.
So I did that and I just hit the open mic circuit and just started, and then realised, then found it like a love of stand-up comedy that I didn't know was there either. So,
and talking about a menagerie of grotesques, how did you find the open mic circuit?
Well, it was interesting to be actually 30 at that point, or 29, because it's a very demoralising process to suddenly be put yourself at the very bottom of a barrel and to go around to open mic rooms having, you know, I had proper jobs for the government, well-paid jobs that I quit, and was suddenly in rooms begging for open mic
time. But you quit before you were open micing?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, no. Sorry. I'd sort of stay part-time and do.
Sure.
But yeah, but to be going around saying, hi, I'm Anne, can I have a spot? And they'd be like, yeah, and come back in 6 weeks. And very humbling, isn't it?
I started when I was around 27, I think. 20, yeah, right. Something like that. And yeah, that was enough that I'd go to a student gig feeling like, hey, they're young, I'm young. Oh, I'm not young.
No, yeah. So it's interesting. It was an interesting time. It was a bit...
And what kind of material... Did you walk straight on... When you said into stand-up, were you weaving together stand-up and characters, or were you going on entirely in character, or did you use Ray Lee on stage? What was the starting point of the
I think
stuff?
I tried to do it as characters a couple of times to start with, which was a big ask. And then went right back to doing story-based stuff. So sort of very... the stories that I already had on rotation with mates, those kind of stories became my stand-up. So I started doing very personal kind of just anecdotal stuff.
And what was the first one of them that you thought, hey, this is what was your first reliable closer as a newer actor?
Oh, actually one about... And having a new boyfriend and not being able to use the toilet and then shitting my pants in front of him. Old Faithful.
I'm glad I asked that question.
So, yeah, clever stuff.
Yeah, that's a useful way of passing the information here. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And so that was a reliable kind of a closing bit.
Yeah.
And you're clear. I mean, you know, your show is excellent and the stuff I've seen of yours on YouTube is excellent. I was watching earlier today the... your set from Sydney last year.
Oh,
the cum in the mouth.
Yeah,
stuff.
A bit rude, isn't it?
I mean, it's a bit rude, but what is, I don't, you know, I insist that anyone listening to this who's thinking, oh, it might not be my sort of thing, give it a go. Because it's not gross out stuff. There's something genuinely unique about your delivery, particularly in that moment.
Yeah,
I'm going to talk about cum. Yeah, imagine that. Ugh. Like that, you're able to sort of do the material, and then one of the parallel tracks of the material is commenting on the material. But it's like the commenting on the material is even more real than the material.
Mm-mm-mm.
It's not. It doesn't feel like it's artifice. It doesn't feel like it's contrived. It feels like it's genuinely you going, yeah, I know.
That
was a weird choice.
Yeah.
And there's something very you about that. There's like a particular quality you have that is to do with your connection with the audience.
Mm-mm-mm.
I don't know. It's not really a question, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think I somehow feel like even those subject matters are disgusting, that I have a distance. Like I think that delivery of like, oh, no, I'm going to tell you this. I'm, you know, it's almost like, sorry, I'm coming out. I can't help it. Gives it a, I don't know, removes the, it doesn't.
It's not icky somehow.
No, I don't, and I don't know either, but I don't feel that it's icky. And it is, but I don't feel that it's icky when I'm saying it for some reason. It's weird, yeah.
I want to just talk a little bit more about that because that's a really fascinating sort of an idea that you're able to, without disavowing the material, you're not going, oh, this is horrid.
Yeah.
It's just something about, it's not quite that it's matter of fact. I'm trying to think of a bit from your show the other night that might, can you think of any, like a similar equivalent from your current show?
Current show where, I guess, I mean, there's a whole bit in there which is quite gut-wrenching about keep falling in love with the same man.
Yeah.
And it's about I keep falling in love with guys who don't want relationships and yet I sign up, you know, up for them over and over again. But I think it's something about telling people like that, like, I know.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, I'm aware. It removes the... it's like how you tell anything, and I remember telling when I have to tell it the first few times, like this particular show, when I did it for the first time in Adelaide, I got quite a few messages afterwards saying, from mates saying, are you okay? Because when you deal with dark subject matter, you do have to have a certain performance distance where you get to know the material and then you can deliver it rather than be feeling it, if that makes sense.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think that there might be something in that as well, is that it's not a play that you're delivering, because stand-up's very different, but it's like I'm okay now. It's like you've dealt with it. I'm okay now with this, and I'm just telling you about it. Isn't that funny that I've been doing that, as opposed to, God, you know,
yes,
I'm still in pain here.
I absolutely agree with you, and yet there is also something in your show at the moment. You're talking about your apparently disastrous relationship status,
yes,
and those mistakes, and you're able to place yourself in it right now,
yes,
whilst we sort of get that there's sort of not inverted commas around the pain of it,
yeah,
but we're sort of okay with you, and we're not worried about you.
Yeah, and that's important, because you know, earlier on in my career, I think, and you know, earlier on in a run of a show, I can sometimes, that line can be a bit unclear. And there's nothing worse for an audience, I think, than sitting in there going, is she all right? Like, you want to be out. Like, I want to deal with that stuff, because for me that's the greatest connection you can get with an audience, is to delve into that area, because there's people in the audience going, me too, and that's for me the most powerful thing about comedy. So I like getting into that stuff. But I also don't want people to leave the show going, oh, I don't reckon she's all right.
Yes.
It's tricky.
One of the most vivid parts that I remember, and because I saw it in the gala as well, the section about the family, the seeing a family running together,
you
paint this lovely kind of shiny, squeaky, inflated picture of this awful, happy family.
Yeah.
Is that a reflection of your own family situation? Is the family that you come from problematic, such that you're like, there's something really cathartic. Like you said, there's a lot of people going, oh God, those people are awful
in
the audience. Mm. And I guess part of that is to think, oh God, wouldn't it be nice if I had a family like that? Do you know what I mean? There's kind of both things going on.
Well, no, I think my family, I've got quite a nice family, like a good childhood, but a very normal family in terms of, you know, fights and not even fights, but just, you know, normalness, not trying to present something to the world that isn't real. But again, it's just that obsession I have with things that look perfect.
Yes.
And anything that looks perfect to me, I'm going to investigate it.
So to what extent are you confined by the reality of the situation? If you see you overhear, if you eavesdrop and you hear something, presumably that's the starting point for then a kind of an imaginative journey.
Yeah. And a lot of my stuff is based in, you know, I'm sure this podcast is like, do you give away tricks on this podcast?
Oh, yeah, 100%. It's the only reason it exists.
No, but I mean, like, a lot of my stuff is, you know, as with most comics, is the kernel of something true. And then and I've got a very active imagination. So always my stuff is where my mind went with what that family is actually like, or, you know, what's actually going on for somebody. So it's always a little bit the truth followed by my imagination taking off. And the characters as well aren't their creations too. They're not direct rip-offs of anybody. It's a sentence or two I've heard combined with someone I've seen, combined with something else that merges into a person, I guess.
One of the things I was most struck by in terms of the sort of the, not just the glee of your, there's two things, I don't know which order in which to talk about them. One is the double denim dirty daddy.
Oh, yeah.
So you do an amazing act out of, the story is that there was this super squeaky clean family, and it turned out that he had a secret family. Yeah. The daddy had a secret family somewhere else. He's a dirty.
Yeah, double daddy.
Double daddy, right. So then you've got and then that kind of dovetails into an impression of a kind of uncle on the dance floor, flicking your bra strap. And, you know, in a really horrible kind of a way. Now, that is, There's something about... that's where I'm going with this. The end line of that routine is, men are rank. And I know I had to run out of your show in the last 5 minutes in order to go and do my show the other night.
Yeah, yeah.
So I believe that... I mean, you said in your Facebook message, you said, oh, it's just me ranting about men. There is something really refreshing, I guess, in your specific take on men.
Mm.
Because it doesn't seem to be a politicized take on men and feminism.
Mm.
And yet it is really, it feels really grassroots feminism. It's quite an earthy sort of,
yes,
this is disgusting, fucking shut up.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And I think that's, because I feel like, you know, I mean, there's feminism in the bigger sense with the theory and the, you know, and the broader political discussions about feminism. But for me, feminism is much more personal than that. And it's about the day-to-day kind of grind of men being able to push forward with what they want to do and with the confidence that they're given by birth versus women and their, like, self-analysis and their, like, self-doubt. And that, for me, is the key. And I guess that's probably come from being within the comedy scene, you know, and looking around at what's going on around me, and the struggles that I've had or other female comedians have had versus this sort of inherent confidence that feels that it exists. I mean, my male comic friends will probably say, you don't know what you're talking about, but it's a sort of, that's for me is the battleground, is that very interpersonal stuff.
So can you talk to us about the final routine, the bit that I missed? I mean, partially because I'm just keen to know what
it
was.
Yeah. It's about me dealing with a guy that comes up to me after a show who's quite long, but it's about an aggressive punter who in Australia I see all the time, different versions of this guy. Is like, and he came up to the male comic standing next to me. He's like, you're the funniest fucking comedian in Australia. And it's this male aggression that I feel regularly. And it's not coming from the male comics. I think that's a misconception in the broader community about the comedy industry, that it's the male comics. I don't feel that. I feel on an equal footing with them. It's really the audience who I have an issue with. So I talk about this particular punter, and then I talk about the sort of people that go and see Jim Jefferies and the aggression that I've seen in those audiences. And the kind of this weird feeling at the moment that these white males are oppressed by something, and who knows, no one can put their finger on what it is that they're oppressed by, but they seem angry and oppressed.
Yes.
And it's fascinating.
Yes, it's I think for my part, I think, and I certainly didn't coin this phrase, and I keep forgetting it every time it comes up on the show, so I've got to think about what the phrase is, but when you're conditioned, when you're accustomed to privilege, then equality feels like oppression.
Yes.
And I think that's what's happening at the moment. Mm-mm. In terms of people are getting called out on their privilege.
Mm.
And as a result, they're going, I don't feel privileged. I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm not getting any special treatment.
Yeah. You're like, well, I have to go to work every day.
Yeah. Absolutely, you do. But you also don't suffer when you're at work every day from the same institutionalized things that other people do.
Mm.
Or that women do, or that non-white people do.
Mm.
And it's, do you feel there's kind of a cultural context in comedy at the moment of that realization being dealt with?
Well, yeah,
because it feels relevant. Your stuff feels culturally relevant.
I guess it's the current environment. It's the Trump. It's Trump, I guess, that's led to this. It's, you know, it's that him winning that election that's really just, I guess, triggered me into doing it, I guess. And a lot of I'm hearing a lot of stuff from female comedians at the moment along the same lines of dealing. But I'm particularly interested in the male aggression. I feel it coming off audience members.
And do you feel that when you're on stage or exclusively after shows or both?
Not when it's my own show, not at all. Not anymore. I feel it out touring mostly, and mostly in, to be honest, regional Australia or outer suburban kind of city areas. Not always, but... and I also just feel it... I mean, last year I did a group show with a couple of comics called The True Australian Patriots.
Yes, I've seen a couple of your YouTube little, you know, trailers for the show, but everyone was raving about the show, and I'm sorry I didn't see that.
Yeah, but that certainly exposed me to this segment of male anger in... And this is an extreme version of it. This is neo-Nazis. But this sort of, white male something's gone wrongness.
Yeah.
I guess you'd call it.
Yeah, kind of white male rage,
yeah,
isn't it, really?
Yeah, yeah. And it's something I feel and I'm fascinated by. Mm.
So did you feel kind of threatened? Did you feel under threat by the kind of online reaction to those...
A little bit, yeah. Once it kicked off and once we were doing the live show, there were some days when I was like, am I going to be walking along and a van's going to pull up? Because, you know, the original, the actual Patriots who we were mocking did find out about it. So
that's a specific group?
Yeah, there was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The I can't remember their names. The True Australian... No, we were the True Australian Patriots. They were called the... something Patriots Front or something like that anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you regret doing that?
No.
Was it worth, in terms of the fear, was it worth, I mean, it's just crazy, isn't it? Because there shouldn't need to be the fear.
That's not
a sort of price that you should have to pay.
Yeah. No, I don't regret it at all. No, I'm happy I did it. Yeah. To shine a light on that kind of, and also comedy-wise, it's gold. Like, they're dumb.
I saw one of the videos. I may later retract this line of reasoning because I don't want to make a habit of referring to YouTube comments, like ignore everything under the line, I know. But someone said it was someone accused you, or you, the three of you, of cultural appropriation.
All right.
Do you know what I mean? Almost like you're stealing our dumbness.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sort of think, at what point do you, like, that's one of the most frustrating things is that, and Patton Oswalt has described this very well in his latest Netflix special. He's got an excellent bit about how people use the code words.
Yeah.
You know, the let's not call them the bad guys, but people who are extremist right wing.
Yeah,
bad guys. You know, they're starting to learn the code words.
Mm.
So they're going, oh, well, I'm triggered by your trigger. You know what I mean? So to accuse you of like a cultural appropriation because you're doing a character that is a white Australian woman.
White supremacist.
A white supremacist.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's terrifying. It's kind of hilarious
and
scary.
Yeah.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
So this is Anne. Really good fun to talk to her. Huge fan of her work. She has she's one of those people you can hear in the way she talks about her act that she's very kind of blasé about it. Oh, you know, I just do this. But she is just such a grab bag of talent. She's very, very skilled, really funny writer and has a really fresh and original voice. So we'll get back to Anne in just a second to hear more from her. Now, you, possibly you, but certainly lots of people like you, have been signing up to become recurring donors to the show in order to access the secret private... I've got to stop calling it the secret podcast. It's a private podcast feed. Every time I say it's a members-only private podcast, it sounds like it has adult content, which is absolutely not the case. But if you go to comedianscomedian.com/donate, then you can join up and get access to... extra content from previous guests that did extra content. That's now the only place to find that, including people like Dara O'Brien, James Acaster, Sarah Millican from her very first appearance. And there's some even more stuff from Tez from that very interesting interview that we released a couple of weeks ago. So you can do that. But there are also lots and lots of other things, including Comedy Critique, where so far Mike Sheldon and Neil Harris, newer acts, have both been subjected to or have both enjoyed the critique of not only myself, but other members of the ComCom Pod community. And basically is a sort of a reflexive process where they I put a bit of their material out on the private podcast, and then we all get together and say hopefully helpful things about it. That's been working really well, and we've got a new one coming up with newer act Charlie George as well to look forward to. So there's those. There's also my own Edinburgh Festival philosophy nuggets, philosopher nuggets. I'm badly in need of a rebrand. I'm badly in need of sitting down and working out what to call any of these things and picking and sticking to a thing. But at the same time, you know, maybe it's fine to just let them be loose for the moment while we work out what they are. There's lots of other bits and bobs on there as well, including, of course, and for the first time ever, an episode of Redacted, the extremely private, not-for-public-broadcast live show, is now being broadcast, but not to the public, just on the private RSS feed. So, comedianscomedian.com/donate, and you can get to hear a fabulous secret episode with some secret guests recorded at the Secret Welsh Comedy Festival. So if that isn't enough to tempt you over to the dark side, I don't know what is. Philly Boots, please, get stuck into that. You can, of course, still make occasional one-off donations to the show, but it kind of makes more sense to become a member, set up a little tiddly recurring donation that just drips away in the background. You wouldn't even notice it, and get lots of extra stuff for the privilege. And finally, I want to say thank you to everyone at the Secret Welsh Festival that came along to a huge room for me to sell it out for my tour show, for Like I Mean It. There are a mere 25 to 30 versions of that show left in the run, and they've been really good fun. So if you are anywhere in Britain and you're near one, comedianscomedian.com/tour will give you all you need to know. Coming up soon, Shrewsbury, Swindon, Farnham, Southampton, and plenty more places besides, including a great big swathe of shows in the north, as well as Glasgow and Edinburgh. So get on that tour page and come along and see the show that the critics are referring to as Goldsmith Knocks It Out of the Park. That's very satisfying to see that in the Sunday Times culture section. So thank you to the man that wrote that. Now, that is all for this bit. Let's get back to the brilliant Anne Edo Edmonds.
Tell me a bit more about... I don't want to get the title of your show wrong. Mm-hmm. Remind me of the title of
No Offence, None Taken.
No, sorry, your TV show.
Ah, The Edge of the Bush.
The Edge of the Bush. There you go. I thought I'm going to be careful with it. So, is that your first experience of making your own material? You wrote it?
Yep.
Played all the parts?
I played the four main characters. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, that was my first ever TV show, yes. So, I mean, I've been involved in telly projects, but this is my creation. So,
For how long have you been trying to get it made? Is it
really in Australia, we have the ABC and not much else in terms of place avenues for comedy. So, I guess I've been in discussions with them, you know, for maybe 3 or 4 years in terms of let's make something, and me, you know, you sort of pitch something and that's not quite the right time or whatever. So, but, yeah, I can't remember when I actually started. I maybe was writing it for a year or something like that, and then got it made, got some money, yeah.
And is there a sense – certainly is something I always come back to this example, but I saw a brilliant sketch show at the Edinburgh Festival years ago, a British sketch show called Cowards, who then went on to have 3 15-minute made as a kind of a semi-pilot, semi-series.
Yeah.
It was absolutely brilliant. People will probably find it out there somewhere. And then that didn't go on to get a full series.
Right.
And that, at the time, I remember thinking, I am not going to bother writing anything because if that can't get made.
Yeah.
I mean, presumably there's an equivalent thing over here in terms of there must be a huge number of very talented people trying to get stuff made, getting all the work, doing all the work, and then not having it happen.
We just got so few opportunities here. As I said, the ABC is really it. So, yeah, there's only a select. I mean, my thing is 5 12-minute episodes.
Okay.
And I think if you're not going after the half-hour sitcom idea, which, you know, could be on in 2020 or something if you're going down that road. If you think about something different that's smaller and more manageable, then you've got more hope, I think, especially for a first project.
And when it comes to writing, when it came to writing that show, was it in development with people? Were other people contributing ideas and kind of going, no, you should, you know, do you have that kind of level of production?
Yeah.
Producers going, I think it should be 4 people, not 3 people.
No, I basically, you could sit around and wait till you've actually got a contract signed and the money in your bank account. But they sort of said, yeah, we're going to make something with you. And so I just wrote it. I just went away and sat. I genuinely just wrote it in a library on my own.
How long did it take? Oh, you said a year.
Well, no, not really. I mean, the actual writing of it, the first draft, probably took a month or something like that. But, yeah, the whole process of editing and re-editing and things like that. Once I got on a stream of writing it, it just all came out in sort of one spew. I don't know. It's that's how I did it, yeah. Can't remember. Sorry, I've forgotten the original.
No, that's all right. The original question was very vague, I'm sure. But talk to me then about what the difference in that experience of writing stand-up. Do you sit down to write your stand-up? Do you sit down at a laptop or a notebook and write stuff, or are you...
Not really with stand-up. I'm more of a dot point. I'll often have ideas out and about, and then I do have to sit down at least and write them into dot point form, hopefully with a punchline, but often not. And I'm much more of a go into the open mics and just say it type comic than a sit down and write it perfectly, memorize it. So I'll muck it, I'll get it out just on stage is the way I do things.
And one of the things that's always scared me about the idea of writing sitcom or basically writing anything else is like, I've got all of this experience at writing my stuff and I've got all of the different mistakes I've made and, you know what I mean? Those like strategies for getting myself out of tight spots writing wise. That to put all of that to one side and go, oh, something completely different now,
yes,
I find pretty terrifying.
Yeah. Well, I didn't – I mean, it for me it just felt like story along – I mean, because I operate in stories really rather – and scenes. You know, a lot of my stuff is scenes rather than just –
Yeah.
Then I felt like it was a bigger version of that and a longer version of that, of my imagination. It was actually liberating just to be able to go – like get it all.
Yeah, this doesn't need to end in a punchline immediately.
Although I didn't, one thing I, in hindsight, I wrote it without knowing the ending of it. And then that was, you know, I'd just move on from one idea to the next and then got to the end and worked out the ending at the end. I'd be interested to know if that's how authors operate. I'm sure everyone operates differently, but, and then I sort of had to go back to the start and work it. You
tweak
know,
it so
yeah.
it was a bit more end buried in the beginning.
Yeah. Which I think if I was doing something again, I'd try and work out the ending first and then start. But it did make me wonder about authors and whether it's just a stream of consciousness or whether they sit down and go, I know exactly where this book's headed and now I'm going to write it.
God, I can't imagine.
I don't know
that.
Either.
I've got one of my favourite stories about the writing process is Breaking Bad.
Oh, yeah.
Whereby they would deliberately paint Walt into a corner every week. So it was just like, yeah, let's put him in a situation he can't possibly get out of.
Okay.
And then 12 of us are going to brainstorm for 2 weeks how he could possibly get out of this.
That's awesome.
And then the genius of Walt is he makes that decision in 2 seconds on stage.
Yeah, right.
So, I don't know how that's applicable to comedy.
But in that instance they always started with the ending because they start with the problem, don't they?
They start with the problem.
That's interesting.
They go, let's put a gun to his head and see how he could possibly get out.
Yeah. That's interesting, yeah. I think something like that is good rather than a stream of consciousness. I don't know.
And when it comes to actually filming the stuff, when you're playing four different characters and you are presumably not directing it yourself.
No.
So do you need to, how much prep time do you get to try to, or do you get any time to make sure that the director and the editor with whom you're working share your vision for it? Because particularly with four characters, that's it. You're even more of an auteur than a general sitcom writer or even someone starring in their own sitcom.
Yeah.
Like you absolutely, you've all got to be on the same page,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I was so lucky I had a Kate McCartney who, I don't know if you guys have had the catering show.
No.
Like viral thing. Anyway.
I say confidently as if I've watched everything in the UK, but I'm personally not familiar with it.
As my director, and she completely understood the vision, and she also understood, because I was the creator of it and the characters, that I would have an equal role in, you know, we worked together beautifully. Mm-hmm. Like we didn't, there was no push and pull, or there was a clear understanding of what I did and what she did, and it worked quite beautifully in that way. You know, that I was on set involved in a lot of decisions and but, of course, she was – she sort of – I feel like she – because she's such a visual person and a bigger idea, which you have to be as a director, a bigger ideas person. She had that under control, and the knowledge that she had that under control meant that I could concentrate on my performance. It's almost like we took those two roles – yeah, like, you know, because I guess when you're an actor, direction about performance is much more important than when you're a comic actor who knows sort of what they're trying to do.
Yes. Did you have situations where she'd go, okay, go back to how you did it in the first take? That was more effective.
Yeah, yeah.
She knows what you're trying to get at.
Yes, and she had the eyes on the camera that I didn't have. So she's like, oh, actually, when you think you're doing it, you think you're conveying that, but you're actually looking off in the wrong direction and we're not even getting it. You know what I mean?
Okay.
So it was an awesome experience. I was very lucky because it was a very low budget sort of fastly, you know, we didn't have much money and much time to pull it together. So if I hadn't have had someone on board who didn't get it, it would have been a disaster.
And were you in on the edit?
That was
from day one. You went on the edit.
Oh, they did. The poor thing spent. I think I went for a little holiday, and they mucked together a sort of rough edit, and then I came in for the next 2 weeks and just sat there with them, and we went. It was interesting. We had an excellent editor, and they already had it. They already had a lot of it, you know, in place when I got there. They were all on the same page with that as well, but they. You know, a lot of it that is in the script. If you're very clear in your script as well about the vision that you've got, I think that it's worth spending so much time on the scripts because it pays off.
And were you developing the script with someone? Did you have a script editor?
I had Greg Larson, who was also in True Australian Patriots, and another guy called John Campbell, who both came in at various points and gave me. John Campbell was more in the early stages when I just needed to float an idea, and he went and he'd give me a push in. You go, yeah, keep going, or have you thought about this? And then Greg was more towards the end in terms of, we need to cut. Now the budget's saying we can't have a car in this scene anymore. What are we going to do? Yeah, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Okay. So what's your goal within comedy? What would you like to happen with that show? Do you want to be making TV or movies or what's the dream scenario 10 years from now?
I think, live performing for me has become extremely important. I think if you had have asked me 8 years ago, I would have been like, TV show. And now live comedy to me is really important and something I don't want to stop. I'm not one of those comics that wants to get on the telly and then like that'll be it for live performing. So I think it's something that, It's a combination of both those things. So still being able to be a live performer. And I think the ideas that you generate in stand-up and the characters then, as they did with this show, lead into the television stuff. And I think that's a very sound way of working too in terms of audiences are your best, your best judge of whether you're on the right track. So if you're already doing stuff on stage and you've got an audience laughing, you're like, okay, there's something to go with here for the TV.
What aspects of your live work do you find most pleasurable?
I think the hour-long show and having an audience with you for that amount of time and the pure, like, stand-up is the delivery of ideas from your head out of your mouth and an immediate reaction to that. And when you're in that, when you're on stage and you're in the so present that you're just up there and so connected to the audience, that's probably the most joyful thing in the world for me, I reckon, is that presence on stage with an audience.
And what, I've just remembered your, at the end of your gala set, vote Trump. Go Trump.
Yeah.
And what aspects of your live work are, what do you see as the bits that you could work harder on, or the bits that, not work harder on, but are there things that elude you in stand-up that you think, I wish I could?
Yeah, I think still the communication of maybe bigger ideas that I have, it'll be interesting. I'll often start a run of shows with ideas that are a bit bigger or a bit deeper about the world, and then they get chipped away at. And sometimes there's a bit in this show that's gone that I'm disappointed in myself for.
I love hearing about stuff that's gone. Go on.
Oh, it's just a bit about, it's not even that, it was just a bit about like social anxiety and committing to catching up with people and wanting to set everyone around me free, like in terms of obligations.
That's a nice idea.
Yeah, and how that's like chipping away at the foundations of society, that kind of talk, because society is based on people catching up under duress. But you know, like sometimes I just, like, I'll say it, if it's not getting the laughs early enough on, it'll just get chipped away at, and then it'll vanish, and I'll be like, I like that bit.
And do you think that might be because I've experimented with things along those lines, and for me the reason they don't work is that's a real trigger for the audience to start worrying if I'm okay.
Could be. And if you're not, and with this show as well, this is the least ever run-in I've had for a show coming into the comedy festival. I'd only done it 4 times in Brisbane and then arrived with it here. Compared to, you know, I've normally done a run in Perth for 2 weeks.
And are there presumably kind of component bits of it that are up and running in clubs?
Yes.
Or is it all... Okay, right.
Yes,
okay.
And then there's these bits like this social anxiety bit that had only been said 4 times before Melbourne, you know, and then... Mm-hmm. Yes, and it does give the audience that sense of, is she all right with this bit? I don't know. And also it's talking about, oh, is she all right? Yeah, so you go down that path and then suddenly it's gone from the show.
It's almost like social anxiety is too, it's almost, I'm not going to call it a taboo subject, but it's like mentioning, it's almost like, you know, you can tank a gig by going, hey, is this okay?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It
introduces a measure of doubt that is actually harder to deal with than an inappropriate or off-colour joke.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
you can be edgy. You can, like, do an abortion joke or a rape joke or something like that. This is not my material, but, you know, those kind of, like, really difficult topics that can split a room and be problematic.
Yeah.
And actually those are sometimes less problematic for the sake of your relationship with the audience than... doubt.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And worry. Mm.
Is there a bit of someone else's material that you wish you'd written? Is there a particular observation or a particular character maybe, or a particular...
Do you know, I'm so bad with comedy because I'm not a fan of comedy, if that makes sense. Like, I don't often listen to other people. I'd be happier at a music gig or something, you know. I'm trying to think.
That's a really interesting answer in itself. I mean, hey, there was that guy in the Ramones. Stop listening to anyone else play guitar.
I don't know. Like, nothing springs to. How arrogant is that? No one's got a bit. No one's got a bit that's better than mine.
And who do you go and see at festivals? If you go and see anyone at festivals, who are your go-to
I'll often see. So I'm trying to see all the other Barry nominees.
So be polite.
Yeah, to be polite, to check it all out. But I'll often, like, I'm going to go and see Richard Gadd tonight. It's always nice to see something that's not, you know, I guess I spend all year with the comics in the rooms doing stand-up, and I've heard a lot of it. It's nice to go and see some cabaret or something theatery, something that's not just the microphone and someone talking, as valuable as that is. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I do that, but I do like going and seeing madcap shit.
Yeah,
do you know what
not,
I mean?
Yeah,
I really think, like going to see something different off the wall. I saw an American comic last night called Fortune Someone from the headliners show.
Yeah.
It's just great. It's just a voice and a look and a style and an accent.
Yeah, I've just never different. Heard before. Yeah. But I think that's a comedian thing is show me something, like we need to see something really extreme.
Yes.
These, you know, to make us laugh now, it's like, I need to see someone nude running around on stage or something because it's just...
From the word go.
Yeah. I need to see... Like a Dr. Brown is someone I always used to go and see. That's a common kind of comic thing is you just want to see something else, I guess. Mm.
Are you happy?
Ooh. You know, in comedian terms, no. I mean, yes, sometimes. But I am... I'm well familiar with sadness. I'm right across it. So I go through, you know, I'm up and down. It's not clear cut for me. It's quite a roller coaster. Mm.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So that was Anne. You can find her at AnneEdmonds1 online on Twitter. You can go to her website. You can check out a lot of interesting stuff she's doing. You can see The Edge of the Bush. If you're in the UK, you might need to do something nefarious with a VPN in order to see that. But there are definitely clips available on her website, so you can wet your whistle and see if that's your sort of thing. I really recommend seeing her live. She's such an accomplished comedian. Really good fun to watch. So... thank you, Joanne. Apologies once again for the delay in releasing that one. And more stuff coming soon. Remember, if you sign up to the private podcast feed at comedianscomedia.com/donate, you too can enjoy Redacted, Comedy Critique, Edinburgh Fringe Philosophy Nuggets. Philosopher Nuggets. God, stop saying that. Don't. On no account is anyone to use that expression anywhere. I will not let it catch on. That's hideous. But, you know, it's going to be my 25th festival this year. So I think it seemed an appropriate time to share some of what I've learned over those 25 years of having my mind blown by incredible things. Why don't we do this? Let's get on the Comedians Comedian Facebook group and tell me your favourite single moment or show from all of the Edinburgh festivals that you've been to. Let's do that. You can find that on Facebook. Search for the Comedians Comedian podcast group and click to sign up and we can have a chat about it on there. So that is that for now. After the horsey preamble noise, you will get to hear the thing that I recorded a couple of weeks ago about basically be mooning around over the idea that I've got a second child on the way. I'm sat here recording this in the baby room that currently my first child lives in his big boy bed. We've upgraded the bed and now he is going to, I mean, in October this year, he's going to be shunted out of this while a new baby arrives where he's going to be put. No idea, not really enough rooms in the place. I built him a little Wendy house 2 weeks ago, so maybe we'll just pop him out there in the garden. I think he'll be happy enough. So you can enjoy some rambling, post-ambling thoughts coming up. But if not, this concludes the podcast, and I'll speak to you soon. Bye for now. And this is going to have to be a very swift post-amble because I've got to go and collect the boy from his childcare thing that he does on Fridays. And, what will we talk about? I mean, really, my life at the moment is just... Hey, did I tell you we're pregnant again? We're pregnant again. I think I sort of alluded to it last week, but we totally are. And we're due in October, so that makes this year even more of a sort of going to ground. It's really weird having been through the experience of... I'm not going to say been through the experience of pregnancy. I don't mean personally.
but been through the experience of being pregnant as a couple before, knowing a little bit what to expect. But of course, there's this total wild card of a running around 2-year-old in it. This is funny. He lost his mind recently. We're in tantrum stage. And he is now, I would say, 2 or 3 times a day having a screaming meltdown about something insignificant. And there's a very funny Tumblr about this with someone, not my own kid, but someone has sort of started aggregating a thing where they give the reasons, the supposed reasons for their toddler's meltdown. I can't find it now, but it's very funny. So have a look for that on Tumblr. Is anyone on Tumblr? Who knows? But screaming meltdown in the swimming pool changing rooms for 20 minutes, just a naked crying boy for 20 minutes. And I couldn't do anything about it because my normal tactic, change the scenario, check to move the space, take him from one room into another. I couldn't. He was crying and wet and naked. And that had to be the one session where there was like 4 other dads there. So everyone was kind of looking at me and doing that kind of pursed lips, raising the eyes like, you know, there it is. It's just acknowledgement. People were just acknowledging it, not judging, which I appreciated, but nor, you know, no one can do anything to help in that place. So not in that specific place, but in that situation, all you can do is just go, I acknowledge this. It, you know, hey, we're doing this now, are we? Okay. So that's very, very exciting to think what it will be like. And part of me, obviously, there's all the love and the idea of like, I know what they turn into now. They turn into these little people that love you. It's so exciting. Also, I'm excited to go, right, new baby again. I've got new baby skills. I can do nappies. I can do all of that stuff. And of course, tiredness, epic tiredness. I mean, wouldn't it be great? Can I have a sabbatical year? Can I? I definitely want to try and save up some money this summer and try to pay for some paternity leave, which is one of those fun things that freelance people don't get. So it would be really nice to take some of October, all of November off, work in December and try and, if you're running any well-paid Christmas gigs or corporate engagements in December, give me a shout. Because I'll be working my little pods off, not that I need them anymore, in September. And then with a view to kind of just January or maybe even January, February, just kind of unplugging from all of it and just getting back into what last time we termed pregnancy lockdown. I'm really relishing it. I'm so excited. It's lovely to tell you guys about it. I know I kind of mentioned it very, very briefly last episode. But it's a really, it's such a happy thing. It's such a happy thing. And it's pretty hard. Obviously, it's very hard and scary and weird. And then you recover. And I feel like there's at least a roadmap. And I know at the end of it, you get a really fun little person. And the Boutros gets to be a big brother. And well done. I think 3 of you separately made the joke about there being a second one, which means Boutros. So it might have to be the Boutros and the Boutros. So it's so lovely. It's so lovely, and I feel really, I'm going to say blessed. I'm not going to say blessed, but I do. God, I feel lucky. Baby times again. And then there's a big change. It's a big change mentally from being a cool couple with a kid, because we're a cool couple. From being a cool couple with a kid to being a family of 4. That's very different. All the travel that we do, all of the zipping to London and back and staying at people's houses. It's one thing when it's like the 2 of you and a little pod. And then just the idea of the 2 of you and 2 pods is just a radically different thing. And I shall leave you with this. I'm sorry, it's a baby wang, but I'm allowed to... that is not a phrase that I want to be associated with the podcast. I'm yammering on. It's a baby yammer of a one, but I feel the occasion demands it. The funny thing is, when you announce it on Facebook the first time you and your partner are pregnant, everyone, parents and non-parents alike, chime in with, this is so wonderful, this is a fabulous thing. The second time, the people who are already parents of 2 kids and know about the oncoming storm feel no social compunction whatsoever to conceal their glee at how fucking hard it's going to get. So many, like the first time, you would never say to someone who wasn't yet a parent who was going to be a parent, you'd never go, it's going to be the hardest thing ever. But when they've already got one, you're like, you're in the gang now, you want it, you know what it's like. God, it's going to be so hard. Like 2 or 3 separate people said, you'll never feel rested again. So we have all of that to look forward to. So what a lovely thing. What a lovely thing. And I tell you what, sorry, I definitely will finish with this. I've spent all my doing shows about kids vouchers. So I'm now in the position now where I'm going to have to come up with some stuff that isn't to do with, you know, I've done the journey into parenthood. I've done all that. And now I don't do anything anymore. What have I got to talk about? I don't do anything anymore. This year's show, which I can now reveal, is on at 2:50. This is advance warning. 2:50 every day at the Liquid Rooms Warehouse, the big one, a 250-seater at 2:50. And it's my 25th year of doing the Edinburgh Festival. 25th year. Performed at every single one of them, either a full run or a load of street shows, or in 1 or 2 years, I just kind of bobbed up for a long weekend and did a few street shows just to keep my hand in. Just to maintain the thing. So 25 years worth of performing professionally at Edinburgh. I'll do some big thing about that at some point in the future. But a 250 seater on my 25th year at 250 at the Liquid Rooms Warehouse. Did you see what I was trying to do there? I was trying to combine the 250 sound with warehouse. Warehouse. Never doing that again. But I can't wait. It's called End Of. The show is called Stuart Goldsmith, End Of. And the poster is fucking superb. It's poster season on Comedy Facebook right now. And I'm kind of saving mine up because it's not ready. Does that count as saving it up? It is not finished. But I'm really so excited about it. Matt Crockett, the photographer, and Daniel England is designing it for me. And it's based on a cool concept from Mr. Jed Feffers. But I'm really excited about it. I'm really excited about the show. But the show at the moment is, I think I'm there. No, I mean, I'm absolutely not there. Don't hex it. But it's just that phase of like, I'm worried that I'm not worried. Maybe there's worries ahead. We'll find out tonight. Reading show. I'm recording this on the previous Friday. Reading tonight for the tour. And in the second half, 5 or 6 new bits. I want to rest on my laurels with the old new bit preview second half. 5 or 6 new bits. Stuff about a squirrel. I'm not going to go into this now. I have to go and pick the boy up. Right. Goodbye. Love you. Goodbye forever.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.